You can see, you can see it here.
Test 1 2 3 4 5 5 4 3 2 1.
Check.
Oh.
Do it again.
Test 1 2 3 4 5 5 4 3 2 1. Today's date, it's February 1st, 2007. We're at the Atlantic Coast Bank at 8th and Center Street, Fernandina Beach, Florida, 32034. The following interview is being conducted as part of the Amelia Island Museum of History's Veterans History Project in partnership with the Library of Congress. We are interviewing Andrew James Curtin, whose date of birth is 15 September 1940, and his place of birth was Scranton, Pennsylvania. My name is David Harlow, and I will interview Mr. Curtin on behalf of the Amelia Island Museum of History. Assisting me is Mac McCaffrey, who will operate the recording equipment. I will now begin the interview. What was your period of service?
My total period of service was from June 30th, 1958, until June 30th, 1963.
During which conflicts did you serve?
Vietnam.
What was your rank?
On retirement, with Lieutenant Commander.
Where did you serve?
I served, you're looking for the duty stations I had? I served in a number of ships and squadrons. My first duty station on commission in June 1963 was the USS Preston, DD-795. And I was, I was on board Preston as a, in the engineering department. I went to flight training in December 1964. Following completion of flight training in July of 1966, I was reported to HC-1, Helicopter Combat Support Squadron 1, at the Naval Auxiliary Air Station, Ream Field, Imperial Beach, California.
Excuse me, would you spell that, please?
What's that?
The field.
Ream, R-E-A-M.
Right.
And I served in HC-1 until July of 1967, excuse me, September of 1967, when the squadron was broken into four different units. I went from HC-1 to HC-7, Helicopter Combat Support Squadron 7, based in Atsumi, Japan. And the squadron's mission was three missions: fleet logistics, bird rep, and helicopter and combat search and rescue. I served that squadron until January of 1970, when I was transferred to Helicopter Training Squadron 8 as an instructor pilot at Naval Air Station Ellison Field in Pensacola. And from that of March, I think it was March or April 1972, and I was transferred to HS, Helicopter Anti-Submarine Squadron 7, by way of HS-1, the Helicopter Anti-Submarine Squadron 1, Readiness Training Squadron. I served in that squadron and HS-7 until October 1977, where I was transferred to the Navy Technical Assistance Field Team in Army Shmag, Iran, Tehran. So we left there.
Spell, please. Iran?
Iran.
The location in Iran?
Tehran.
I understand.
Upon return from there, 1979, in February 1979, I was assigned to Naval Air Station Oceana in Virginia Beach, Virginia, as a search and rescue pilot. I served there until my retirement in June of 1983.
Why did you enter military service?
I had a always wanted from when I was a small child, I wanted to go to one of the service academies, and I preferred the Naval Academy, so I made my goals to make it into the Naval Academy.
Did you attend the Naval Academy?
Yes, I did.
And you graduated?
1963. My total service includes my reserve time that I joined right after high school in order to qualify for a fleet appointment to the Naval Academy.
Those are the only questions that I had written down to ask you. And the theme for our interviews here is for you to tell us your story. So if you have story and or stories that you think it would be worthwhile putting on a disc, or you just like to share them with the rest of the world someday, it's all yours. Go ahead and tell us your stories.
Well, of course, the period in which I was in the military, of course, encompassed Vietnam, which was, of course, very, very much of a controversial period in American history. But going back to the first one, my first stage duty station was on a destroyer right out of the Naval Academy before I could get into flight training. That was a very interesting tour of duty. It taught me a lot about the Navy and seamanship and ship handling and a lot of things like that that I enjoyed. Flight training was interesting. I was a little bit... my stay in flight training was extended by a sports injury that tore up my knee, grounded me for 4 months. Finally got back into training and was able to, when it came to picking out what I wanted to do in naval aviation, I looked up there and decided I'd go helicopters for a couple of reasons. One, they were interesting. Two, it was the fastest way out of the training command. The other pipelines for jets and props were half again as long as the advanced training for helicopters. I said, I want out of here. So I went out. And when I got to my first flight duty station, the squadron's mission, HC-1's mission, was to provide all the carrier onboard, carrier utility debts for all the CVAs at the time. The rescue detachments, plane guard. And that didn't sound real interesting to me, so I tried to get into, I succeeded into something that had just been, last couple of years before I got there, organized into the combat search and rescue detachments that were operating off of the destroyers and other aviation facility ships in the Tonkin Gulf in support of the airstrikes into North Vietnam. And so I got into that and made my first deployment from HC-1 was in, I think we left in February of 67, returned in late August. During that time out there were quite a few things happening. Among the most significant was a terrible accident on board the USS Forrestal.
Hmm.
And we spent 13 and a half hours flying that one. Came down from SAR Station for the we picked the stations up in the Tonkin Gulf, North SAR and South SAR. We came out from North SAR and stayed on board the Oriskany was the ship that was running the support operations to help the Forrestal. We flew firefighting equipment over and to the Forrestal while the fire was still going on. Some of the guys that I knew that were on there had some really rather interesting experience. And one friend of mine told me that he was an F-8 back there in the pack when he said, "Yeah, no, I did it." But next thing he knew, he was standing on the bow of the ship. That's a long way from the pack in the back to the bow of the Forrestal. He made it up there somehow. But we flew about all day, flying cans of foam and other firefighting equipment over to the Forrestal. Which we were a pretty small helicopter. I was flying the H-2, which was a smaller single-engine helicopter at the time. It was a typical carrier plane guard. We also had them configured for SAR with high-powered engines and armor plate and one thing or another.
That's SAR, SAR, SAR acronym for?
Search and Rescue Combat, CSAR, Combat Search and Rescue.
Thank you.
And
sorry about that.
We, After they got the fires under control more or less aboard Forrestal, that evening we thought we were through. We were kind of relaxing on board ship, and all of a sudden the call came out for us to man our aircraft. The hospital ship from Da Nang had closed Yankee Station, and so we started flying the casualties from the Forrestal over to over to, it was a sanctuary, I believe it was at the time. And mostly, the majority of the patients we transported that night were burn patients. And it was pretty grim. So we stayed overnight on board the Oriskany and flew back up to our SAR station the next day. It took us about 2 days to get the smell of burning flesh out of the helicopter because of that. And during that cruise, the guy I was flying a co-pilot at that time, since my first deployment, he and I made 14 rescues in the Tonkin Gulf.
That was the McCain incident, was it not?
McCain was on board. That's where our paths crossed. Sorry, we never met. He was assigned to one of the A4 squadrons on the Forrestal. The rumor I had heard it was something in the wiring, the weapons wiring of his aircraft that popped that Zuni off, that hit the aircraft in front of him and released its centerline drop tank, and when it hit the ground, that's when the fire started. I don't know if that's true, but that's what I heard. It was McCain's aircraft. And it wasn't his fault. It was a wiring failure on the part of one of the ground crew, the ordnance men. But it was an awful mess. That was the only time we crossed. And the only other time I heard about it was when I saw some film of him getting shot down over. I guess he went down right over Hanoi. Mm-hmm. And there was he couldn't get away from anything. They landed right in downtown. Somewhere, and they got him right away. After the Forrestal fire, I went back up there. My boss Tushwit, my pilot. We made with 14 rescues in that time.
Jack, who please?
Meiling. And I have lost touch with him. I tried to find him. The last I heard of him, he was out somewhere in Utah. And that's been years and years ago. But we had a pretty good disaster. Another thing that we noticed over there a lot of was the almost continuous stream of East Bloc freighters and other ships going up the Gulf completely unimpeded and into Haiphong Harbor, and offloading war goods and anything else they want to. And also, not just them, but a bunch of American do-gooders going up there, Quakers and what have you like that, to go up and deliver mostly probably medical supplies and stuff like that in North Vietnam. It's very discouraging to see that sort of conduct going on. Yeah. After that cruise that came back, they said it was an HC-1. The squadron split up, and I went to HC-7, retained the same missions. But then I was going out as the detachment ONC. And this was a very interesting duty in that I was a junior lieutenant, and I was going to sea with the helicopter, co-pilot, 8 enlisted men, thousands of miles from the squadron, independent duty, ONC. It was really great.
ONC.
Officer in charge of my detachment. And I'd be aboard these destroyers and cruisers, and it was treated like a department head, things like that. It was very good. Mm-hmm. In fact, there was one point when I was on the Chicago for a couple of cruises. At that time, any of you who may remember, you were in the Navy, you were retired. The Chicago was a Talos ship, mm-hmm. and it had these huge, the superstructure went way up to get above the Talos mounts.
Mm-hmm. Talos.
The Talos missile.
TLOS.
Yeah. And it was like an 08 or 09 level. Well, if you weren't a department head, you had to walk the ladder up to the bridge. And so most department heads, of course, were commanders. But I was a lieutenant, but I had department head status, so I could ride the elevator.
That's it. But a perk.
That was a perk. That was, yeah. I seemed to spend a lot of time getting called to the bridge by the skipper. So.
You were assigned to small boys or cruise surface boat type ships,
yeah,
but you did get on and off carriers
later on, mostly. And with this tour duty, it was all destroyers, cruisers. I was on Chicago, and the Long Beach for cruisers, and I was on a multitude of destroyers, the Decatur, the England, Kuntz. These were, of course, long since retired ships. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there was a thing that I'm still probably pretty famous for in the helicopter Navy. I am the only guy that Lazio know who shot off a rotor blade and lived to tell about it.
Shot off a rotor blade? Mm-hmm.
How'd that happen?
Well, it was on Tet, 1968, as a matter of fact. I was in the Tonkin Gulf on board the Dewey. And we came up one day, the staff was up there, and the staff officer needed to go to our company gun destroyer. And loaded up him and whatever else, and took him over there, and lowered him down the hoist. And the deal was he was going to stay there for about an hour, conducting some inspection or something like that. And I said, well, we'd go out and do some gunnery practice with our M60s and what have you. Carried M60s, M79s, M16s, what have you. So went out, went about 15 or 20 miles away, put a smoke float in the water to use that as a target. So as we're going out, it was a bad day. The weather was about 400 overcast, about 4 or 5 miles of mist. And when we came running down by the smoke, popped the nose up, turned, and came down. And the last thing I said to my crew members was, watch where you point the barrel of the gun. We didn't have any uplock stops to keep the barrel from rotating into the rotor arc, because one of our geniuses at our support detachment in Kiwi Point had gotten them in and said, what are these? Threw them in the trash can. So our gun mounts didn't have that on it. So that's the last thing I said. You know, I said, clear to fire, watch where the barrel points. The next thing I hear is a violent vertical vibration. My feet come off the rudder pedals. I see something fly off the aircraft. It's all happening. Less time than it takes to talk about it. And so I dropped the collector, which is the power control in the helicopter, all the way down to the bottom, popped the nose up. I was about 50 feet doing about 90 to 100 knots when this happened. Popped the nose up. I had some cyclic control, fore and aft control. Didn't seem to have much other control. And just held it down there. As it came down, I put down in between these violent vibrations. I determined just about at zero ground speed, popped the nose over, hit the water. Bounced out of the water, hit again, and it rolled over on top of me. Now, the H2 is supposed to roll to the left, not to the right, the seat that I'm sitting in. But as it did, it rolled over on top of me. My co-pilot never got his head wet. It sank, rolled over on top of me. I took a big deep breath, and it sank like stone, because I got about 4,000 rounds of ammunition and flat curtains and all the rest of that hanging in that aircraft, because it was our normal equipment. And we sank like a stone. There was plenty of gas. And I was about 35 feet underwater when I finally got out the door.
What, 35 feet?
Mm-hmm. It was a dark day. I had no idea. All I know is I didn't know which way was up. I looked and I saw the stub of the rotor mast. But I said, you know, I didn't know whether, I assumed that below me, but so I just, you know, I exhaled a little bit and just followed the bubbles to the surface. And I was almost to the surface by the time I saw any light, because it was such a cloudy, overcast day. It popped up. My co-pilot was out, one crewman was out, and I looked around. About that time, the other crewman popped up, so we were all okay. We flashed our life preservers together and got our radios out, and called the ship, and they came the guys. They'd been following us pretty closely. We were doing some calibrating of the TAC, of the radar, helping them calibrate the radar bouncing against our TACAN readings. And so they knew when I didn't show up when I disappeared off the scope on one pass, the radar chief called the bridge immediately and said, you know, he's not there. Okay. So we were in the water about a half hour, 35 minutes. It was cold. It was January. And they came alongside and yanked us out of the water. But what had happened was the M60 had evidently malfunctioned and fired one round, and it hit a place on the rotor blade where it would do some damage. The H2 is a strange helicopter. I don't know if you've ever seen them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they've got little things called flaperons on the mm-hmm. on the trailing edge of the blades, and that's what you control. You're not moving the, when you move the controls in an H2, you're not moving the blades, you're moving these little flaperons, and aerodynamically they move the blades. So push pull rod that goes out the blade and then turns to go out the flaperon. Well, that area there is reinforced, it's doubled. And when the bullet evidently must have hit right there and had enough force, it tore the lifting surface of the blade off. It didn't tear the spar off, but it did tear the lifting surface. Everything outbound of that, outboard of that. Mm-hmm. So we had no lift left. And that was the object I saw fly past my face. But I had to get that thing slowed down to zero ground speed because I was sitting in an armor-plated seat. That if we'd hit with any forward force, it would have broken loose, and I would have gone through the windscreen, and I'd never pulled out. That'd been history. Mm. So I had to get it slowed down before I went in the water. So the years have passed. The Navy developed this. Since then, they developed this helicopter escape trainer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was always a star of that show. I was the first guy out of there. I went through that 3 or 4 times, and I was always the first, up to the point where the instructor accused me of cheating. Because and they'd say, "Oh, yeah, you're the guy. We read about you." So that was in right about early January 1968 when that happened. But I stayed in HG7 and ran a number of detachments out on the line, either on any number of the ships, including the Long Beach, which was a nuclear cruiser. That was an interesting ship. But until I reported to the training command in HTA Pensacola as a flight instructor.
Did you enjoy that tour as a flight instructor?
I enjoyed flight instructor until about the last 6 months of it. And I just, so, you know, I see the same, after a while, you see the same mistakes over and over again. And that got a little. I was glad that tour would. I was glad to see that tour come to an end. I enjoyed it, but it started to get a little bit old. It was so repetitious. At that time, we were doing. We had a. If I remember right, we had a pilot training. The training target was like 900 a year, and that was unrealistic because by that time Vietnam was winding down mm-hmm. big time, and we were finishing these guys, and they were going to desk jobs. Somewhere they find out about two thirds of the way through that tour, they had a big riff, and I had two students at that time. One was a USNR, and one was USN. The USNR guy was about that close to getting his wings. He got riffed. The USN guy got riffed also. But a year later, he was back because he got into it because they couldn't throw him out. So I don't know why they bothered riffing him in the first place. Since he had a regular commission that couldn't get rid of him.
What's a riff stand for?
Reduction
in force. Yeah. And about that time, they riffed almost the Marine instructors because those guys they lost a bunch of them, right? And all of a sudden, these guys started coming up with all these service connected disabilities.
After the training command, you got into a different kind of helicopter.
I went into the H3 at the and helicopter anti-submarine Atlantic Fleet. That's mm-hmm. why I went from Pacific Fleet to the Atlantic Fleet, and I went to HS. Well, of course, at the time, the now defunct HS1 Helicopter Anti-Submarine Squadron 1 was the readiness training squadron for the East Coast H3s. I had to go through that transition to the H3. I had essentially never flown it before. And then I went from there to HS7, which was a fleet squadron for, and we were assigned to Carrier Air Wing 3. That was an interesting tour in that we participated before we got into the, into our deployment aboard the Saratoga, which is what Air Wing 3 was assigned to at that time. We took part in one of Zumwalt's last ideas, the sea control ship. Mm-hmm. Bad idea. Anyhow, that was the sea control ship evaluation. If you remember the time, the idea of the sea control ship was the an inexpensive ship, relatively speaking, on which you would be, which you could tailor for the mission it was going to fly. So this was the secret force of the idea here was to have a protected lane of traffic so we could move valuables, you know, in convoy style across the ocean. And it was almost an acknowledgement that we were going to cede the blue water ocean, the blue water war to the Soviet Navy. All we were going to do was try to be able to control the seas around our around our high value units like mm-hmm. convoy or something like that. And so HS-7 and our sister squadrons, HS-15, were flying at that time flying the new model of the H-3, the H-3H, which was a multi-sensor. Most of the earlier H-3s were single-sensor sonars. This was a multi-sensor. We had Jezebel, we had Relay, we had Sonobuoys, we had MAD, and we had our sonars. So we were like, and plus we carried torpedoes. Mm-hmm. And it was 1974, I guess, we went in the spring, and late winter, early spring, went on the final evaluation of that. And if you've ever been in an evaluation, you have all these Pentagon people walking around with clipboards, you know, pervy snippers and strap hangers. It gets a little crowded on the ship. But we proved that the concept would work, but I don't know why we'd do it. We'd want to do it. We played with our own nuclear submarines, and most of the time, if we could get an attack boat, we could have some realistic stuff. If we had to settle for a boomer, of course, you can't do much with them because of national strategic. They're considered a strategic weapon and mm-hmm. under the command of the National Command Authority, not really the Navy. Navy just mans them. And if you had the attack boats, you could play. If you did, the other factor we had out there were the Russian intelligence boats, and we had at that time this brand new. Maybe harm to talk about it 30 years later. Sonoboy called the 53. Mm-hmm. It was a piece of equipment at the time. It you hit the water, and instead of just giving you a line of bearing, it could split the signal and it could give you a range and bearing on a target. And of course, it was very hush hush and all that sort of thing. And we were putting these in the water, but we were not putting these in. We were simulating dropping them, and. We'd go inventory everything we had before each flight and all that sort of thing. I was up one day on the barrier patrol, and I was dropping my sonoboys, and all of a sudden we heard voices on one of the coming through one of the hydrophones. It was a Russian boat crew from one of these intelligence boats had gone over and yanked up one of the sonoboys. See, it hit, yanked it up, and the first thing I told my crew is, get back there and inventory those 53s, and we treated. And I could hear them. They're all excited. Then they pull up and they hear this, you know, this Russian cursing, and it's a 41. the old Lofar buoy, which nobody cared about. The ocean is ocean bottom is papered with those things. But I said, well, that's it. So I just came down. I just dove down, made a low pass over, and we went by and gave him the finger on our way. But we never lost about 53. But
how long were you in the HS world?
I was in there from April 72 to October 77. We went from there, after that project was over, summer of the 74, we went on board to Saratoga for med cruise. We worked up first. And those of you who was living down here during those times, Saratoga had a terrible reputation at the time for material condition. And in fact, the CO that was on board when we reported was relieved. It was one of these things. You know, everybody's trying to put as nice a
spin,
face on it as possible. And so we're going to have a hail and farewell party for this guy. And that was one of the most unpleasant and uncomfortable, maybe. Social situations I was ever in. We all had to go, so we all went. And the guy who replaced him eventually became things done, and he became
Bob Dunn.
Bob Dunn, yeah. And he became last I heard. I know he was Comnat Air Lat.
That was his last assignment. Yeah. Air Lat. Uh-huh. He's still around.
He's a hell of a good guy. Yeah. He was a darn good CO of the Saratoga, and the ship start back up after that.
What was the nature of the defects in the ship?
The nature of the defects, they're mostly engineering. They were the ship, part of it was where it had lived its entire life in Mayport. It sucked in a lot of, Mayport Harbor's shallow, and it would suck in sand and all that. The main induction mechanism was bad. There were rumors that it actually settled to the bottom of its pier. I don't know if that was ever true, but it had serious engineering problems. And they brought the air wing aboard early. Those of us that were down here, the squatters that were at Cecil and at Jax, to try to get the ship, making material inspections. And I had the trunks and the shaft alley. One of the shaft alley. And
thank you very much.
Yeah. So I would the first time I went down there, the shaft out the trunks weren't too bad down to the level where the weapon where the magazines were. Unfortunately, the magazines, as soon as you went down below that and got into the engineering, I opened the shaft alley hatch first time I went down there, and took one lift of air in there, and I said, "I'm going down. You guys stay up here. I come running. If I don't come up in about 3 minutes, come send somebody down for me." Because the air was just awful down there. It felt like I had a canary down there and throw it down there to see what happened. But we made repeated inspections of that, and very very little actually changed. Things were at that during that cruise because there was so much else to do. But the ship did improve, except the day we entered the Med, I was up on a plane guard and the H3 because we were the only helicopters aboard. We no longer had these utility detachments aboard the carriers since we'd gone to the CV concept. So the HS squadron had to provide the plane guard and all that. So I was up there on a plane guard. I look up there. Here comes the Russian destroyer that's going to tail us. And all of a sudden, I see a puff of white steam and no wake. Saratoga's just gone dead in water. That was the day we entered the Med.
Did Saratoga at that time have problems with catapult and resting gear the way Kennedy's had it or not?
I don't recall. No, we had at least one A6 crash. We had multiple accidents on that cruise. We had an A5 hit the round down. We lost two F4s mountains crashing in the mountains in Italy. They had to bail out, and one of them crashed into the mountains. And we had one A6 took a cold cat. I was in the ready room, and I saw it, and he just took it.
I'd like to ask you a question about carrier-based aircraft hitting mountains. Did they send the HSs in there?
This is it was in Italy. The weather was rotten. What we did, we picked up the crew. Two crews were involved, two F-4 crews. One crew bailed out over the water. He did an Iron Man descent and ran out of gas and bailed out. The other one hit a mountain because he had gone over the mountain, and he was turning, and he flew into the side of the mountain and just almost perfect with the slope of the mountain. And I think one guy survived out of that. The backseater survived out of that. The locals found him carrying him out of there. We picked up, squadron eyes in, we picked up two guys that just took their F, they were out of fuel, they just came down through the clouds, and when they broke out, they ejected. And we had A5 with the executive officer of the A5 squadron hit the round down at night, and nobody survived that, obviously. And we lost a helicopter, got backed into he backed into the water. It was a rough cruise on in that respect. And I think I was just the problem with the F-4 is the guy had this hydraulic problem. He had an asymmetrical lift. He couldn't get his he couldn't get his flat. He got his flaps down on one side, but not down on the other, and he couldn't come aboard. And they insisted that he try to land at the Naval Air Facility in Naples, Capodichino. We're across the straits there at Sardinia. Was a joint use NATO base. Weather was clear as a bell. You could see the front moving across the Med. Well, they sent him over there. He had 10,000 feet of concrete runway to land on. It's just that they tried to land at Capodichino. So,
What was the name of that camp?
Well, it was the Naval Air Facility in Naples. Just it's a joint use with the civilian airport at Naples.
Capodichino.
Capodichino, yeah. And I can't pronounce it. Oh, I can't spell it.
All right.
But it's I think it's a joint use airport for the Navy and civilians civilian facility for Naples.
Well, it sounds to me like almost your entire career was operational.
Yes. The only. Right from being on destroyers.
Except for training command.
Training command, yeah. And that continued. Well, I stayed on the. I transferred off of out of HS 7 in February 1975 and came back to HS 1, the Readiness Training Squadron at JAX. That was for shorter. I'd been free of hand.
RAG instructor.
RAG. Yeah, so I came back. I was operations officer, maintenance officer, and executive officer of that squadron at the time I was there.
How long were you there?
I was there from February 75 to October 77 and continued flying the H-3 and all that sort of thing. So that was a good tour of duty insofar as that goes. I enjoyed that training environment better than
that was operational training.
Yeah, it was operational training rather than, primary training to teach them to take off the land.
Yeah.
This one teaches them systems and tactics and things like that. That was more interesting.
Yeah.
So I stayed there for, I guess, about 2.5 years.
Yeah.
And following that's when my wife and I got assigned to Iran, to the Army Shmag in Iran. And that was the first time I would say I went non-operational. I was in a staff situation.
Let me back up and ask you a question. It's a personal interest thing, but you maybe can draw some light on it. When you were instructing down there at Ellison, were you teaching Marines as well as Navy?
I was teaching Marines, Navy. I had a lieutenant in the Royal Danish Navy. I had Italians. I had Chileans.
so everybody got the same training.
Oh yeah. And we were teaching everybody. In fact, one of my Marine students. Is employed by the same company I am, CJ Systems. He's an assistant training officer for the company up in Pittsburgh. He doesn't fly anymore. He has some health problems, but he still works in the training department up there.
I didn't mean to bother you. Go back to Iran if there's some excitement there.
Well, Iran was exciting. It wasn't exactly the most desirable duty when I got the word that I came home with my wife. I said, "I think we got that overseas duty station." And she said, "Great, where are we going? Brussels?" I said, "Not exactly. Think farther east." So she was assigned to the training section of the Navy section of the Army Shmag, and I was assigned to this other command called the Technical Assistance Field Team, which was an advisory body to the for what the Iranians already had bought. And the case I was sent over there was to be most associated with was the second biggest foreign military sales case that the Iranian Navy was involved in, and that was the RH-53D helicopter, the mine countermeasures helicopter. Interestingly enough, that's the only helicopter mission in the Navy I never flew, but I'm the advisor for it. I had 2 days in Norfolk to go talk to some of my buddies who were involved in mine countermeasure squadron to get at least look at the equipment, see what the paravanes looked like, what the magnetic influence sled looked like, what the acoustic detection devices looked like. And that's about as much as I knew about it when I went overseas because I'd never flown a mission. But that didn't matter. They knew even less. So, but they also had an H-3 squadron. These were Augusta Sikorsky, ASM-61s, and I got. They were nice aircraft. They were like our D models. They were long range, single, sonar only. And I got checked out in those. I was a flight instructor in those. I did some flight instructing for the Iranian Navy squadron. The H-53 was our main. A relationship with the Iranian Naval Air because that was what we provided. The Italians had provided them with the H-3s, And the Iranians were trying to get us to help out because what the Italians did, they came over, they gave them, I think it was like 10 or 11 H3s. Yeah, dumped a bunch of pubs and left. So they separately contracted with Sikorsky for airframe and hydraulic and all that support, and with GE for engine support. And then they had a little squadron of Augusta Bell 212s, Hueys, and 22 Hueys. And they had three helicopter squadrons in the Iranian Navy. And I did fly with them in the H3s.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about those people over there, and we're seeing it come true here in Iraq, because all those people are like, they wanted us around over there so they didn't have to take responsibility for anything.
Mm-hmm.
As long as we were there, they had somebody to blame.
Mm-hmm.
So a certain amount of this opposition to Iraq war, which says, you know, the longer we stay, the less they're going to. Certain amount of that is true, unless we force them to pick up their end of the slack. I was talking to this one guy who's the executive officer of the H3 squadron, the 53 squadron. He was telling me he was completing his training for the using the acoustic towed my countermeasures equipment. And I'd come down that week. I'd gone down. He'd had his check ride. He'd just come in from his check ride that morning. And I said, "Well, how'd you do?" You know, he's fine. You know, they all spoke reasonably decent English. And I said, "Yeah, fine." He says, "Now I don't have to do that anymore." Now that's the attitude. Now our attitude: as soon as you get qualified, of course, that's when you hit it. Their attitude is, "I'm qualified now. I don't do it anymore." that holds in just about, and I think the Iraqis are probably with that kind of Middle East mindset and that Islamic mindset. That's the way they think, and trying to get them to do preventive maintenance, forget it. You're messing with Allah if you do that. You don't plan ahead. Anything beyond about a week, and you're getting into Allah's realm. You don't want to go there. And I didn't learn much in the way of the language or anything, but I learned a little bit about how Islam works, and I'm really not impressed with it. But they are like that. They won't take responsibility for their actions. They want someone else around. Like the Saudis have had the C-130 since the '60s. We still have Americans over there maintaining those aircraft.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Yeah. We got this country, the Air Force, they did 130s, 19, 20 year old kids maintaining the things.
Mm-hmm.
But not that. They got the Lockheed Aircraft Service that still does it.
When you come out of Iran, where'd you go next?
To Oceania. Naval Air Station, Oceania. Of course, we got in Iran, we got towards the end there, that's things that went downhill. That's when the revolution
took place. Yeah.
And we got a 50-yard line seat to somebody else's revolution. That's not a nice place to be. We weren't the target so much. Some Americans did get killed during that time and wounded. But mostly that was just common crime, because when the society undergoes upheaval like that, all the normal restraints, police, fire, rescue, things like that, all that stuff breaks down. So it was just Tehran was a city of 4.5 million, no law.
And out of the woodwork come the gangsters.
The gangsters. One Air Force major I knew slightly was coming home. We had the curfews were on. He was coming home one night just about curfew time. Walked over to a neighbor's house for dinner, and he was coming home. And he got jumped in front of his own house. He got shot. Well, he shot back. Got one of them. And they were going to try to arrest him for murder. Well, what that turned out, we got the Air Force got him out of there. What that turned out to be was a rent dispute. He hadn't paid his landlord the rent, or landlord claimed he hadn't gotten the rent. And he put a couple of bad boys on him, and they were hiding in the bushes outside. The naval attaché to Iran at the time, with Captain Roy Hollingsworth, he was a helicopter pilot. I got to know him over there. he was getting his visit. The embassy was downtown. We were you've probably seen pictures of where the embassy, the American embassy in Toronto, was right downtown. We lived up in the north suburbs, like near, not too far from where I lived. Well, he was driving. When he was driving home at night, well, actually with his driver driving him home, he was seeing this, for several days. He was seeing the same car following him. And, essentially, looked like pretty much the same people. He reported it to the only outfit that we had over there that could do anything about it, OSI, Air Force Office of Special Investigations. We had a detachment of them over there. They poo-pooed it. They blew it off. They said you're matching things. Everybody's tense, you know, all that sort of thing. Well, he's standing in his. Fortunately, he'd sent his wife out of the country already. He's standing in his house. And we, of course, we all had walls around our houses over there. That's the way it is. And all of a sudden, shots ring out. Glass starts shattering all over the place. He ducks, crawls around, gets his pistol, goes out the back door, the front door. Sees some figures going over the front wall. Pops a couple of rounds off at him. Next morning, went out. There was blood on the wall. He got one of them. He goes to work that morning. He was going to turn it in. He didn't have a chance to turn this in. He didn't have a chance to. The ambassador calls him down, chews him out royally, and kicks him out of the country. He said, "Well, yeah." He said, "Yeah, you ruining our relationship with Iran." He said, "Yeah." Excuse me. They were shooting at me. So he went out. They got him out of the country, and the Iranian government, even though this was not Khomeini yet, declared him persona non grata, and in fact, they issued a warrant for his arrest. They sent Roy to Athens, but the United States Department kept telling him, "Oh, he's in Athens. We're getting it all set up for you to go back in." No way.
State Department.
So when it came to when we kind of got evacuated out of Iran, and after let's see, the sequence was that Shah left in the middle of January. Of course, he was in ill health at that time. We didn't know it. The French knew it, but the Americans didn't know it. Because the French wouldn't confide in us. Because they knew anything they said to us would be on the floor of the U.S. Senate the next day. That's the way these things work in this country. So, they never told us. But he was, by that time, deep into the cancer. It was eating him up. So he got him. He leaves in the middle of January. Khomeini comes back into the country first 3 or 4 days in February. He runs, we all stay off the streets. We just duck. Get into our houses and stay there. And then about 17th of February, the night before that, I guess, on the 16th of February, they told us, report to the Tehran Hilton. We all had our car, everything ready to go. We've been living out of suitcases for about a week while the revolution went down. And we'd seen they'd had enough there. The newspapers were coming out showing the officials of the Shah's government executed. Mm-hmm. The military governor of Tehran, all the chiefs of staff, all the heads of all the military services except the Navy. He got out. Mm-hmm. Habibullahi, he's one of the sharpest people I've ever met in my life. And he got out. He's been running the Iranian for years. I don't know what he's still doing.
Can you spell his name?
Habib, H-A-B-I-B, O, Lahi, L-A-H-I. I think that's how he was from.
Thank you.
And he was the admiral. He was commander chief of the Iranian Navy. He got to Paris along with the Shah's nephew, and two of them ran the Iranian resistance out of Paris. And he was quite a guy, but the rest of them all ended up strung up, and they had pictures of it in the local newspaper and everything. And finally they told us, after a week of dodging things around the revolution, get over to the Royal Tehran Hilton, and that's where we're going to gather everybody for evacuation. Well, I know that night of the 16th, there were thousands of us in there, Americans. We're still in Iran, military, civilian, everything. Some people had their pets with them. The Air Force originally said, you can't take your pets out. People were euthanizing their pets. And finally the Air Force relented and said, yep. They go out with you in a cage. So there's one Peter that camped on the floor near where I was, had his dog in his wooden cage. That poor dog was going crazy. But we did get the pets out and all that sort of thing. But that night we stayed in there. Funny little anecdote on that. I had been selling my furniture we couldn't sell. You couldn't sell stuff until you had orders out of Iran. Then you could sell all your stuff. Well, of course, I wasn't exactly going out on orders. My next door neighbor, Mohammed, who was a graduate of Ohio State and worked for IBM Iran, he says, "We sell all your stuff, Andy." So he goes, everybody's got an extended family in that country, you know. So he gets all his cousins and all that sort of thing, and they come streaming through my house, and we're bidding on this, and we're bidding on that, and they're selling furniture, selling electronic equipment, selling all kinds of stuff. And I've got a few things there that they might like, you know. My guy said, "Well, you're asking a little bit too high a price." I said, "Well, I throw in this bottle of Johnny Walker Black." Mm-hmm. Right? But they didn't have any money. All the banks were closed. So I said, "Well," Muhammad said, "Don't worry about that. We'll get the money and we'll meet you before you leave the country." So I figured it was a write-off. I wasn't going to get it back anyhow. I'm sitting over there at the Royal Teheran Hilton. Who shows up but Muhammad and one of his cousins? And they've got every sales slip that we had that we signed, and they've got the money. And we go into the coffee shop there at the hotel, and we sit down there, and I did about $5,000 worth of business.
Good for you.
And it was all in reals, of course. So I got the Iranian money is like Italian money. The bigger the nomination, the bigger the bill. So I couldn't be caught with all that money because they were searching. We were getting body searches every step of the way. So I had a brand new pair of high top boots that I was wearing out. I just bought them. So I took all the big bills, thousand real and bigger notes, folded them up, stuffed them down in my boots, and took all the little stuff and put it in an envelope in my briefcase. So when they opened up, they showed me what's in there. That's American money. It's Iranian money. How much? Oh, maybe $100 American, $300 Iranian. Well, they wouldn't steal that. That wasn't worth stealing. So they just leave that alone. And the boot tops were too stiff for them to feel anything when they patted me down. So next day we got out after waiting all the day at Mehrabad Airport for false alarm after false alarm after false alarm. And we thought we were going to spend the night there because the airport was going to shut down at sunset. Well, there was two 747s from Pan Am and a C-141. The Air Force C-141 had come in to pick us up. I got the 141. I got the 141. And a friend of mine got out on one of his 747s. He said the entire crew on the 747 were all cabin crew and flight deck were all captains, all guys. And he said when they got up there, they partied all the way to Rome. They drank that airplane dry. But we didn't have our accommodations were a little bit more Spartan on the 141. But as we finally got to roll and get down the runway, and he pops the nose up and starts up like that. And my wife goes, "What's he doing? What's he doing?" And I said, "Well, there's machine gun nests at the end of the runway. We don't want to trust these guys." So when we cleared Iranian airspace, everybody started cheering, and I reached down in my boots, and there's a young soldier sitting there next to me on a communication text or something like that. So it's next to me. I pull out all this money, and his eyes just bugged like that. I counted the money again, put it away, and then I traded it in, and it was like 80 real to the dollar when I left. By the time I got to Athens, it was about 70 real to the dollar. And the next day, it was down below 60. So I lost probably about $500 in the transaction. But that was fine with me. So we just partied in Athens for a week while we were waiting to get some orders to get us back to the States. And when we got back here, I went to Oceania and flew Station SAR and had some other duties there at Oceania that set me up well for what I'm doing now in the Airport Advisory Commission here. I was the Air Installation Compatible Use Zones Officer at Oceania, the noise abatement guy. And so that's a lot of what I end up doing here with around our airport.
And the situation at Oceania is worse than it was when you were there.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I was there 20 plus years ago.
Yeah.
And
it was bad then, wasn't it?
It was bad. It was bad. They were trying to build right up to the fence, and now of course it's worse. I've been dealing with it. Those kind of issues with on the Airport Advisory Commission here ever since I got on it. And we've been living here. You know, we stayed in Virginia Beach until I retired, and my wife was at. She was. She went to Surfland, then to Staff College, and then to Sinkland, the logistics section. And she wasn't liking that. It wasn't a very interesting job. She came home one day and said, "Hey, I just talked to my detailer. He says he wants to send me to this place called Kings Bay." And she said, I said, "You get back in?" And she said, "I don't know." I said, "You go back there tomorrow morning. You call him up, and you say yes before you forget your damn name." Because I knew about Kings Bay because in the 70s, when I was at HS1 and HS7 down here at NAS Jax, we were... Kings Bay was still under consideration. It was still, they hadn't made the decision that this was going to be the sub base yet. So, but there was all these visitors from the engineering command and all that sort of thing, engineering command, all, coming down here to look the place over, go up. So the only way they could do it in those days was to grab a helicopter and then AS Jackson fly up here. Also, they couldn't do it in a day. So I knew about Kings Bay, and so I said, "Yeah, well, I think we'd like to." So at the time, I'd already retired, and so we moved back down here. So.
And when was that?
We moved down here in 1985.
Okay.
She was still on active duty and remained on active duty at Kings Bay until she retired in October of 89. She was the Family Services Center officer over there at Kings Bay.
Yeah.
And then so that's how we've been down here ever since. And
we're getting close to the allotted time we have, and I think your story has been great. You kind of skimmed over the fact that you went to the Naval Academy. Were there any exciting things that went on during those 4 years?
Oh, absolutely. Every semester. It was always this, whether I was going to be there for the following semester. I had one day, into my first semester, one of my company mates, a classmate company mate, came around and basically said to me, "I'll buy your uniforms cheap."
Oh.
And I never have liked that guy since then. I was not the academic star. Years ago, when I first started hearing about John McCain getting into politics, I heard a little bit about him. And I said, let's see. Then somebody said something about his Naval Academy history. And I found out he graduated lower in his class than I graduated mine. I said, "Well, he can't be all bad."
That's funny.
But... the Naval Academy was interesting. It was 4 years I was there. We never lost to Army. We had Bolino and we had Staubach,
mm-hmm.
and so we never lost to Army. It was interesting. Cruises were interesting. That's where I got into flying. Of course, it's a 10th class summer going to Pensacola. I graduated in 1963.
Thanks.
I joined the Navy in 1958 out of high school. Went to the Naval Academy in 1959 on a fleet appointment. And then graduated in 1963, but only barely. I came that close to being either being thrown out altogether or by academics, or turned back to the class behind me just about every semester. There's always something. It was either engineering or science course. One or the other of every semester was going to be my downfall.
I never made it.
I didn't have any trouble with English and languages and things like that, but I sure did have trouble with some of the technical stuff. But
and at the same time, you wind up. Flying and having tactical assignments as far as aircraft is concerned, and you had a great career and you're still doing it.
Yeah. Temporarily indisposed right now because of this. I lost my medical for the moment. I had a stroke back in November, and I'm trying to get my medical certification reinstated right now. I got taken the physical. We'll see what the next step is when the FAA comes back with something from Oklahoma City on that. But and the company says, the company I work for says, when you get your medical, come back and see us. That's pretty good. But I've it was interesting, and it's one of the places that I figured Iran would be awfully down, but it was kind of a scary place to be under the circumstances. But we weren't really the target. The problem there was you could have gotten very easily gotten killed accidentally. I looked out the window one day in my house, and there's just 8 or 9 year old kids standing over there flipping a revolver around. Every police station and military base has been broken into, the arsenals, weapons, storage areas have been broken into, people have run around the street with weapons, all kinds.
Well, maybe you've done this probably over a cocktail or something like that, and you and your wife talked about it. You had hectic times flying airplanes or ships, small boys. Carriers, combat situation, and then you're finding find yourself in a country that really wasn't very friendly when you were in there. How do they stack up to each other? It's sort of a, which was your preference?
Oh, I'll take operational flying in the Navy in the dead of night off a carrier anytime. Yeah, and ASW was, of course, interesting in those when we were doing it because you did come down to use the sonar, you had to come down into a 40-foot hover at night and lower the dome in the water. And you had to stay there. You couldn't drift around. We had all this Dopplers and couplers and all that sort of thing, but it was all this 1950s electromechanical technology that you used to hold you in place. So ASW was very challenging flying. And there was always training because never ever did we have to do anything for real in ASW.
Mm-hmm.
But we did have fun with the Russian submarines.
Mm.
We go over and get down in the med, they put a submarine behind you, also run down 7 miles astern, drop the dome in the water, and then just start banging on it. Just start going, go active with the sonar and just bang on it.
Would that be a very loud impact?
Because the sound put out by the sonar unit would be quite noticeable if you got it close enough. And they'd hear it through the sub, and it'd be very annoying. Just bang away at him for a while, and then get on the Gertrude, the underwater telephone, and say a few things.
Gertrude?
Yeah.
Underwater telephone.
Underwater telephone. It doesn't work real well, but it's...
harassing.
It's harassing, yeah.
Well, that's an interesting thing. I know you operate with them, and of course, in the med, the opportunity to possibly be on liberty and have people from the enemy be on liberty too. Did you ever run into any crews?
No. The places we went to med, no, I didn't. Naples, and we seemed to spend an unduly large amount of time in Naples. But I went to Palma, Mallorca, and never ran into any Eastern Bloc types in there. We did have a lot of fun in those places, though. In the Med, but we saw the Soviets mostly was out at sea in operations, and where they would try to do things like break up our underway replenishment organization formations, and or try to interfere with flight operations. They had this helicopter called the Hormone.
Mm-hmm.
It's a coaxial helicopter. It's got two blades coming up through the same rotor mast. Mm-hmm. Well, two concentric rotor mass.
Mm-hmm.
One turns this way and the other turns that way, so it doesn't have a tail rotor.
Mm-hmm.
It's very maneuverable, but it's slow. And they would try to fly this thing across in front of the aircraft carrier to disrupt fixed wing launches. So we'd have to get out there and chase them with the H-3. Now, we were faster, but that little Hormone was more maneuverable than the H-3. So we had a tough time dealing with those guys.
How about in the Mediterranean? Do you ever have any mutual operations with the Israelis?
No. Had some with the Brits and other NATO forces, but none with the Israelis. At that time I was in Med, I think we weren't on the outs with the Israelis, but it hadn't been that long since the Liberty had been attacked. I don't know if we had forgiven them for that.
The only reason I ask is I know that shortly after the time that you were talking about in HS, that the Israelis were very interested in submarine activities, both submarine itself and counter-submarine stuff. And I was wondering if they had started doing it at that time. They probably hadn't.
The Soviets had several types of subs in the Med, not the least of which was the Foxtrot, which was an advanced diesel boat built for the Type 21 German boats. So it was much better than most people's diesel submarines. And they would... Our people would play down the Foxtrot. They were more concerned about the nukes. Well, the nukes were dangerous. But I could say, they were so much faster, yada, yada, yada. I said, yeah. But look at the Med. Look at the geography of the Med. You can put a couple of those Foxtrots there by the Straits of Messina between Malta and the coast of Malta and North Africa, right inside Gibraltar. They don't have to chase anybody. They just wait till you come and visit.
Sure.
And it take us so many torpedoes to do anything to the Saratoga. And I said, how many torpedoes would it take to prevent us from launching our aircraft? The A-6, which we had at the time, had to have a level deck. that have a level deck to align its inertial navigation system, where it was, or you're just throwing a piece of iron up in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Because of other, yeah. And they didn't seem to have a didn't seem. I don't think intelligence had a fair had a realistic asset, understanding of what of yeah. the threat that that. That those diesel electrics.
Well, what about today when Germany's building great diesel electric submarines, so I've read?
Yes, they are. And, well, they're not going to be the long range. They're not going to be able to compete with us or anything like that. But for operations like in a place like the Baltic, where the Germans are going to be in today, it would be great.
Sure.
They'll be, and they're super silent. The only way you can find a diesel electric is with active sonar or MAD. You can't find them with a listening device.
Magnetic anomaly detection.
Anomaly detection, yeah. And you got to fly right over them to get that. Mm-hmm. You got to fly right over them. The only other way is an active sonar.
And they're selling them, I've heard.
Where?
They're selling them, Germans are, I've heard.
Yeah, uh-huh.
To who knows?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You weren't in ASW helicopter business when you were on in the Pacific.
No,
I was was there much talk at the times that you were over there, particularly, well, on destroyers, which primary mission, of course, is any sub.
Mm-hmm.
Did they talk about the concern that we should have had at that time with regard to the capability, if a submarine was ever in and around that area, that what kind of hazard, chaos they could have created over
there? Like in the Tonkin Gulf
yeah.
and around Yankee Station?
Yeah.
I don't think there was much concern about
no,
that.
No, there wasn't.
I really don't. And in fact, we stopped sending the ASW carriers out there.
Exactly.
Because they decommissioned the Bennington, the
Kearsarge.
They all got decommissioned.
Yeah.
And so ASW wasn't during. I know our subs came up the Tonkin Gulf
uh-huh.
once in a while.
Yeah.
They didn't like to be up there. That's shallow water. So they didn't. But they did come up there from time to time. But there seemed to be a feeling in the Pacific Fleet that ASW is a back burner item right now.
And there was no threat, allegedly.
Allegedly.
We never saw one, never heard one over there. No. We knew Americans
when
were
I
there.
When I was on the destroyer, my first duty station, we did a lot, not in the Pacific, we did a lot of ASW exercises.
Okay.
In fact, Skipper of my ship one day got so mad because we were such an old beat-up World War II destroyer with the lousy equipment.
Yeah.
He tried to run down one of our subs and I stuck his periscope out of the water. He said, "My, get him!" But no, Skipper.
Jesus. Were you there when the small boys were firing on the shore?
In North Vietnam?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, the gun line.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
You were up on the gun line. Then.
Well, no, we weren't on the gun line.
But you were with the ships that were.
You could see them. Not just small boys, but New Jersey was up there
banging away.
Yeah, and that I think that tactic really really terrified the North Vietnamese because they could hear those damn shells coming and off of something like the New Jersey and when it stopped, you might well be dead. Whereas they got to the point where they weren't too much scared of our tactical air, but they were the ones that lived near the coast. They were scared of things like the New Jersey and the other ships on the gun line.
Well, they could hit what they wanted to hit, couldn't
That's
they?
Right. Yes. Uh-huh.
There wasn't much to hit at that time, but it was a
psychological
thing for the people, as you can know.
Right, and they'd find their anti-aircraft and gun emplacements and missile emplacements and take them under fire.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah. So the gun line is up there.
Is there anything else you wanted to you thought about you'd like to before I close it out?
Oh, I think that pretty much.
You have some stuff here that you'd like us to.
No, I just thought that my bona fides. I've got my copy of my DD-214.
Yeah, you don't need both.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing your recollections with us for the benefit of the Milliam Museum of History, the Veterans History Project, the Library of Congress, and anybody downstream or down, way ahead of us. That's going to want to do research 20, 30, 40 years away. This is going to be available.
One of the best kept secrets of the Vietnam War is the Navy's combat SAR.
Yes.
The only Navy naval aviator during the Vietnam War to be awarded the Medal of Honor was out of my squadron.
Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Clyde Lassen.
Yeah.
Now, what's his name? Who was the vice?
Jim Stockdale.
Stockdale was awarded the Medal of Honor after he came back for his performance as a POW.
Which was a POW, right.
But Clyde got it for rescue, a night rescue in the North Vietnam. Landed on the ground, landed. Yep. His guy, gunners jumped out, laid down fire, and got the two guys from an F-4 crew.
Yeah.
And
said, amazing guy. Yeah.
He's still around, isn't he?
No, Clyde died in 1995 from cancer.
95, okay. Cancer. I remember
Clyde,
I had
please.
Yeah.
Spell his name.
Clyde Lassen, L-A-S-S-E-N.
L-A-S-S-E?
L-A-S-S-E-N.
Lassen. I've met him.
Yeah. And he's a... And the other guy, the guy that was a Marine, was Major Steve Pless, but he killed himself in Pensacola. In suicide, but he was a motorcycle accident in Pensacola, and I was down there as a flight instructor. He got it for his actions in South Vietnam in a helicopter pilot.
And his name is spelled?
Pless, P-L-E-S-S.
Thank you.
That was about a mid-second.
First name? I missed it.
Steve. These guys' names are all in the, you know, if you go over to the museum, Naval Aviation Museum over in Pensacola, they're all up there. You know, Clyde, we never got, there's no, very, very little word about Navy search and rescue in Vietnam. It's always Air Force. I always thought, oh, golly, you know, if they were as good as their PR, there'd be nobody in the Hanoi Hilton.
This concludes the interview with Andrew James Curtin. Thank you very much.